WWT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune into the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, and every second Thursday of the month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio, or if you need to access past programs, email prison@ckut.ca.
Good morning and welcome to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm Virginia and I'll be your host for today. This is our last show of the year, and in that spirit, we wanted to give you a new interview looking back on 2020 with a focus on the George Floyd Rebellion that took place in the so-called United States in the past 8 months. We talked to two people from the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement's New York City chapter about the pandemic, the uprising, and their resolutions for 2021. We hope you enjoy it. We're also sharing audio from Muti Ajamu Aseburo. Muti wrote this piece at the end of November as a new wave of COVID-19 infections were rising in Frackville Prison in Pennsylvania, where he is incarcerated. We think the piece is super relevant given the new wave of COVID infections hitting federal and provincial prisons across Canada. If you are curious to learn more about Muti and hear more of his recordings, you can visit our blog at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com and check out the page dedicated to audio from him. We're short on extra time for the show today, so instead of sharing some news, we're going to go straight into our new audio content. Up first, this new piece, Frackville and the NBA, Same Bubble, Different Results, by Muti Ajamu Aseburo, who is currently incarcerated at Frackville State Prison in Pennsylvania.
Many folks are feeling the yoke of the coronavirus.
Having to maintain a level of vigilance to stay infection-free, have been looking for things that would hold our attention and at the same time take our minds off of the strain of seemingly unsustainable vigilance against an unseen enemy. The National Basketball Association, NBA, provided just such an interest in a model. The NBA playoffs, which led to the crowning of an eventual champion, was both riveting and educational for reasons normally not associated with professional athletes en masse. The NBA was able to complete a championship season because the players and the commissioner agreed to play an entire playoff in a bubble. From start to finish, upon completion of the last game, the NBA didn't have a single positive contraction of coronavirus. Frackville State Prison was in a bubble as well. On that same COVID-19 free trajectory as the NBA, but as time would surely tell, with a totally different result. Listed as perhaps one of its not only coronavirus-free state prisons in Pennsylvania, those of us who are here know that staff would not maintain that prophylactic NBA record for no other reason than some of the staff have a strained hatred for black and brown people so virulent they simply cannot hide it, and as such would soon find a way to put us in harm's way. Some staff here, when it comes to practice, think optional in matters of care when legally it is actually mandatory. Granted, Frackville wasn't testing each prisoner 3 times a day like the NBA, in fact, not testing at all. But at first, no new prisoners were allowed here, and as such, we could not contract it from other prisoners because we were all coronavirus free. Unfortunately, far too many of us were spending too much time looking at each other side-eye and never even contemplated staff as likely courier, even certain introducers of the coronavirus into the prison environment. That's right, staff burst the Frackville bubble. To me, it was never if, but rather when and how soon. One by one, guards started turning up missing and feeble attempts were made.
Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Frackville.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
Feeble attempts were made to disguise why their MIA status was not connected to the obvious. To accelerate some staff members' crash course and virus contraction, many of them are Trumpites, following his pathological edicts to the hilt. Quote, COVID is a hoax. But illogically enough, it's also, quote, going to just disappear, end quote. While off the job, don't wear masks, don't social distance, and washing hands is overrated, end quote. This type of troglodyte behavior is fine as long as they keep it among themselves to self-destruct. However, because they leave and return to the bubble with that magical thinking, you realize that your vigilance is the only act of civilization that separates you from their premeditated savagery. This is as serious and deadly as it gets. The spiritual, psychological, and physical drain on your body is compounded when you easily recognize seen enemies trying to use the unseen to remove you off the face of the earth by increasing the possibility of your contracting the coronavirus, turning a possibility into a likelihood by not protecting or safeguarding prisoners' immediate environment. It matters not whether it's done by malicious intent or negligence, the end result is still the same. Sickness, suffering, harm, and possible death via biological and chemical germ warfare. If you see, hear, smell, or feel firsthand the hate behind the callousness, you will not doubt that the casual nature of white supremacy.
This is a call from Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Brackville. This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
That the casual nature of white supremacy's myth behind enemy lines is genocide at the highest level. The staff started shipping in prisoners from other camps to cover the source of the coronavirus infection. They began spreading rumors that new transfers were bringing COVID in. But the few who have contracted it haven't been out of Frackville nor around any new prisoners from other prisons, because at that point, none had been shipped here. So most of the new initial coronavirus contraction cases have been passed on from contact with staff, from staff to prisoners, not the other way around, as has been falsely represented to the public. For those who are doing the journalist reportage and human rights documenting need to keep a few things in the fore of your mind. One, give as much detail and specifics as possible so the reader can discern how the official version does not add up. I.e., if you say person A and person B were cellies, that is, locked in the same cage cell together, and person A contracted coronavirus, tell us how long they both had been in the cell together and how long at Frackville. Two, whether one of them had just come from another prison or not. What prison did they come from and how long were they at Frackville before contracting? How have they moved since being here? Have they been taking the three basic protection practice serious? It will act as a literary contact tracing. What the reader will quickly discover is that in far too many cases, the only logical conclusion on where the prisoner at Frackville contracted the virus was from someone who goes in and out the bubble every day, staff only. This will help us debunk the constant false media, rumors, misinformation, and outright lies being spread about prisoners and their loved ones. I'll explain it later. Another good example of clear math is one of the recent contractions of coronavirus by an inmate here was an old bootlicking Negro, notorious jailhouse informant, that stays in the face of staff without his mask on so they could understand the information he was giving them about the activities of other prisoners. Clearly, he did not get infected by another prisoner in the bubble. The latest turn of events here have really revealed an effort to throw folks off the trail of the truth regarding COVID infections and contact tracing. When the pandemic first hit, Secretary John Wetzel toured Frackville and came through this very block. I got off the phone with my lawyer just so I could talk to him. I told him that I disagreed with almost everything he has done since being appointed secretary, but that as far as his preparation to combat the pandemic, at least at Frackville, he got it right. Now, over 9 months later, he's failing at Frackville miserably, and it is getting worse. We are on the cusp of having a large outbreak of coronavirus, and death is indeed right around the corner for many of us if people who run the prison don't listen to the insights of those of us on the ground and our loved ones we can communicate with daily. In the bowels of America's Terror Dome, I am Muti Ajimore Saberu, a child from Pennsylvania's other death row, death by incarceration, Philly engineer.
You're listening to the Christmas Day special of the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. That was audio from Muti Ajimore-Saberu, followed by a song by pianist and anarchist Eric Lankin, who served time in provincial prison following charges related to Toronto's G20 protests in 2010. You can hear more of Eric's music online at ericlankinmusic.com, and that's Eric with a K. Up next is our interview with two members of the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement, an organization based in the so-called United States. The Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement, or RAM, is an organization that started in 2017 with the release of their book, Burn Down the American Plantation. We first caught up with RAM in September 2017, and we're happy to have them back on the show. Enjoy the interview. Well, thank you guys so much for agreeing to this interview. And to get started, do you want to introduce yourself for our listeners and also introduce the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement?
So the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement is something that exists in the U.S., the U.S. colonial state, in a number of different cities. There's a few different chapters. It's a political movement that's based on the abolition of slavery, and specifically, like, police, the justice system, and, of course, the United States itself.
Yeah, we're an anarchist organization, a revolutionary anarchist organization, in that we're for the overthrow of the government, and we'd like to see a federated of communes and collectives organized around the country. We're also anti-capitalists, we're abolitionists, we're anti-imperialists, we're a feminist group as well, so we're fighting for the total change of society.
So we got to catch up with you as Prison Radio a couple years ago, not too long after your group had first become public about your presence. And it's great to have you guys back on the show. And the timing is really interesting for us because as 2020 draws to a close, it seems like a good time to do some reflecting on how this last year has gone. And specifically, we're curious to talk to you guys about what is getting called the George Floyd Rebellion, or like the George Floyd Uprising. And so for people who maybe are in prison and haven't had much access to alternative media or internet stories about the rebellion, I'm curious if you can give people an overview, like how you would sum up what's happened since late May. I'm sure, you know, everyone has heard about the police murder of George Floyd, but I'm not sure if people have necessarily heard of some of the other things that happened after he was murdered.
Yeah, it was May 25th of this year that George Floyd was brutally murdered in the streets by a police pig who knelt on his neck, and I think it was 8 minutes that he knelt on him and caused him, or basically executed him in the streets. And it brought out a huge amount of passionate response and frustration with these kind of ongoing and unrelenting police killings that have been happening in the U.S. A few months before, Breonna Taylor in Louisville had been executed by police in her home. So it was kind of building on something that was already like inflaming passions around the country, justifiably so. What happened in the city where George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis was kind of went beyond any of the uprisings that we've seen in response to police killings in recent years. People took to the streets, immediately started attacking things. They attacked a police precinct, the third precinct, drove the police out, burned it down, and people around the country and other cities saw this, and all of a sudden there was this pivotal moment where everyone realized, oh my God, the police are not this all-powerful force. Like, we have the power, we can do this. And people started uprising in cities all around the country. Cop cars were burning all around the country. People were besieging police precincts. Here in New York, you could see that happening, which was incredible. But you could also see the reaction by the police was to barricade all their precincts. And as just as you're driving around town, just on your normal day-to-day life, all of a sudden you saw that there was a flip in where police had been harassing people. Now they were standing in a defensive position with fear in their eyes. So it became this incredible moment where people realized their own power, they lost their fear, and instead the police were the ones to become afraid.
I'd also like to add that the uprising, it should be viewed in a larger context. In light of the original Black Lives Matter uprising that began from Trayvon Martin's killing to Mike Brown. One important thing about that to think about too is during that first rebellion, one of the main protest chants was "Hands up, don't shoot." It was a call for that people wanted freedom, but they also weren't as apt for militant revolutionary action against the state and against the authorities. In this context, there wasn't even, once that third precinct was ransacked and the police were chased out all over the country, people took really militant action, and this wasn't at the, like, behest of revolutionary organizations. It was, like, truly popular outrage. Like, the right-wing media tries to say that, like, that revolutionary group started this, when in actuality what started it was white supremacy and police and U.S. savagery that started it. So while revolutionary groups are outside taking part, like everyone else who had any kind of conscience would be taking part, it was more of a popular uprising, probably the most popular uprising we've seen in decades in the U.S., So yeah, that needs to be viewed within the context of that Black Lives Matter movement from before, but also from the same context of what drove the country to the Civil War in the 19th century. So it's still the same conflict that is continuing unabated. Another important point to make, we should add that it wasn't just predominantly the big cities that were part of the uprising. A lot of people were taking cues from smaller places like Kenosha, Rockford, Illinois. There are so many smaller places that were leading the charge in the uprising. So it wasn't a big city thing. It was a thing that, like, it hit every corner of the country, which is really important. Also, since May, I think people should have noticed this, but places like Louisville and Portland stayed in open rebellion for months after the initial uprising, which showed the how vital and how vibrant these movements were, that it continued. And as this continued, the country has also gotten more politically unstable. You see all this political polarization increasing with large fascist rallies. We have the huge anti-fascist rallies. We have for the first time probably ever, a president attempting to stage a really public coup and trying to delegitimize, if not overthrow, representative democracy in the country, all while the president is organizing public assassinations of anti-fascists, where they publicly killed one of our people and bragged about it on television. All at the same time, you have the liberal institutions who function as a counterinsurgent wing, who pushed Biden into power, promoted could be called bastardization of the abolished police movement to call defund the police. From there, you know, there's positives coming, but this is the whole picture that comes from the May uprising.
So how has RAM been relating to this context? I know the last time we talked to you guys, you were in the process of setting up your first bail fund program, and I've noticed on social media that you guys are now handing out food baskets in Brooklyn. Can you talk a bit about relating to the uprising specifically and tell us how RAM's programs are doing in that context?
Okay, so we've been organizing and, like, discussing and, like, working with people from behind the prison walls for the entirety of our existence as a political project. So, for one, like, the uprising, it wasn't, like, we were caught off guard by how widespread and how courageous it was, but politically we weren't very surprised. So, like, we think we were kind of well-positioned to participate in it during when it was going on, for instance. So we have one project, Support Through the Walls, where we've been writing letters to people inside for quite some time. So that really helped us, one, to to push information inside about what's going on, and to draw a connection between the prison and the police abolition and prison abolition movement. Some of our activities on the street too, like they've been, some things have been forced to change due to the pandemic and due to the nature of the situation. So for instance, we always focused really heavily on political education, and we've done study groups, workshops. We've done that for like years upon years now. Obviously, we did a lot of them in person, but you can't really do that with the virus spreading. So that's been scaled back a bit. The bail fund, we scaled back a bit also. We stopped doing that. There's been, like, serious bail reform in the city, so it's not really as practical anymore. So we figured we should pivot as what, you know, what the realities call for. And we've been doing food serves as well, which we do it to build community support, to show people we're about, and it builds, like, dialogue within the city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's been like a real thing that during the pandemic, there is like, you know, tiny bit of sort of like city funding for food and resources for people, you know, who they consider to be citizens, but not for others. So we want to, you know, kind of help out for that whole that's not met. And the other thing that we were doing kind of at the outset of the pandemic, and that we're actually restarting now, is handing out masks to people who are getting let out of Rikers Prison, because there was really zero protections for people at the beginning of the pandemic inside prison. So we wanted to at least be there, like, as soon as they got out, and give people what they needed to come into a community that's just full of the virus. So that was met with a lot of like support, and people really liked it. So we're kind of bringing that back now that coronavirus is coming back. But I guess like a lot of what we've been focusing on kind of leads to the result of like the George Floyd rebellion. So I think a lot of how we've been positioning ourselves or thinking about what we're doing is in relation to people fighting for liberation from slavery. So it's a really interesting moment, and we're really glad to be able to be working right now, and that people are uprising right now. It's extremely exciting because we feel like this is something that we've always wanted to support, and we can work even harder now. And now kind of pivoting from mutual aid projects more towards kind of building infrastructure, because this is an unresolved issue, and we know the rebellion will be back.
I'm curious to hear more about what you mean by building more infrastructure, but maybe you can work it into your response for this next question. So early on in the uprising, you all organized a demonstration in support of Jamel Floyd, who was killed by prison guards in his jail cell at the Metropolitan Correctional Center in New York. And I know since the start of the pandemic, we've seen a huge uptick of prisoner resistance in the context of, you know, people demanding masks, people demanding PPE, people demanding fewer people in their cells and things like that. I'm curious if you can talk about solidarity with prisoners both during the uprising and during the pandemic, and what that's looked like for you guys. I mean, you're talking about handing out masks to people who are getting out, but what kind of stuff have you guys been doing in terms of relating to people who are currently incarcerated?
A lot of like what we've been doing now, like besides like the mask project, is helping people get the word out about the conditions inside, because there really is, it's really difficult for people to get information out. There's, you know, huge efforts by prison staff, prison administration, to prevent information from getting out about how they're not taking steps to prevent the spread of coronavirus inside. Part of it is doing that kind of support for the people that are like long-term correspondents. And the other side of it is to bring the idea of abolishing prisons back into this movement to abolish police, because we just want to make sure that it stays linked, you know, when people are thinking about people inside. Right now, I think, is a really important time for prison organizing in the U.S. You know, since like the first prison strikes a few years back, people inside have been like organizing very consistently, very methodically, like with a high degree of organization and application of kind of organizing ethics to their work. So there's kind of like a natural alliance between our group and people who've been organizing inside. So we've actually started moving more towards collaborations for upcoming initiatives, and I can't say too much about it right now, but pretty soon we'll have something come out.
Yeah, we've been working more in tandem with other politically minded people inside. Also, one thing I'd like to draw attention to is that, as people know, that the virus, it's very, as everyone knows, it's extremely contagious and it's very deadly, particularly for older people. So in an environment like prisons, particularly since they're some most draconian institutions in the world, it spreads really rapidly, and the guards, the COs, the people in charge don't care what happens to people inside. So it's like people are getting really sick. There's been a huge death toll in a lot of prisons, and the comrade, Russell Maroon Schultz, for instance, has been really sick and really down out. So if people can check out his social media, check out how to support him, he needs a lot of help right now. So that's something we'd definitely like to draw attention to.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the thing that came up in the last question in terms of building infrastructure in the aftermath of the uprising? Like, what has that infrastructure building looked like?
Yeah, something that we're really focused on now, because there's, of course, the problem that after these really passionate and important uprisings, unfortunately, people have to go back to day-to-day life. They have to go back to their jobs to make ends meet. And unfortunately, the police come back in to spaces that were once taken over by demonstrators, our militants. And so what we want to think about is, how do we sustain people during the next uprising? Like, how do we make it so that people can push forward? And not have to return to a kind of capitalist exchanges and being subjected to the threats by the state. So we're kind of looking at that in terms of a lot of different aspects. And the first thing we started doing was building with other radicals in the city. And of course, now a lot more people have become politicized, so that's helped us out quite a bit. And then with this group or this extended network, we're looking at how we can make ends meet. One thing we're looking at, another thing we're looking at is kind of going through and figuring out what are the resources people would need to kind of continue an uprising and push it forward. So we're kind of analyzing these things and then looking at how we can start creating those.
When we initially got in touch for this interview, there had been a lot of recent media attention about how over 14,000 people have been arrested in the context of the uprising, and specifically how more than 500 of them are facing fairly trumped up federal charges. And I'm curious if you guys can talk more about RAM's call for amnesty for all the prisoners and a little bit more about how you've been relating to the repression that came in the aftermath of the uprising.
Okay, well, the one thing, the size, the scope and scale of the repression, I wouldn't say it was startling or surprising, but it definitely truly exposes the nature of the state here and the cruelty, and also how scared they are of the movement and of the momentum the movement has. Anyone who's studied traditional insurgency, counterinsurgency literature, you can kind of understand when a state starts behaving like this, where they start assassinating political opponents, where they start locking up huge, vast swaths of people with just totally trumped up charges, that you can tell that they've totally lost legitimacy and they're doing what they can to cling on to power. So that's it's sad, but it's also a positive in a sense, in that when a state starts getting more, barbaric like this, it means that they know they're kind of on the back foot, which gives people who are fighting for dignity, it gives us a bit more leverage to try to, to try to increase our capacity to make the world a better place. So that's one thing to think about. So it's terrible that there are so many people who are facing charges, particularly the fact that they've used federal forces to charge people for really things that typically are state charges. So that's it's an expansion of the state's repressive power. As far as our calls for amnesty, we believe that anybody who was detained for anything related to these uprisings should have the charges dropped immediately, should be freed if they're not freed, and that they're all freedom fighters and deserve to be not only treated as such, but the state should back off. So one, so we can have our comrades back, and also so we can continue to have the capacity to push the revolutionary movement further. So we believe that the court system itself has no legitimacy and should be treated as such. So we don't view the arena of battle of court fights as being something that we particularly are interested in, but we do believe that we should keep pushing for all of our comrades to have the charges dropped.
We also do think that in the next coming years, the repressive apparatus in the state is going to keep expanding, because conflict that exists. It's not something that can be really resolved. This, if the state was a little bit wiser, they would start implementing some really serious reforms, but they made it clear they're not going to.
So one of the things that I've learned about counterinsurgency tactics is that there's often two sides to the same strategy. There's the super repressive side of, like, you know, round people up, and, you know, you're talking about Michael Reinhold, people getting shot and killed in the streets, and people ending up in jail, and people not being able to get bail, and so, like, sitting in jail awaiting trial. But there's also the side of co-optation and, like, a more liberal, you know, trying to draw the movement into, like, the structures that already exist.
Yeah.
And my understanding of what you just said is that you don't really think that that side of things is happening as much as it could have, or that if it is happening, it's not very successful. Is that right?
Oh, I think it's pretty, it has some success, definitely. The more liberal co-optation side definitely has some success. And we can see it in a lot of different ways. It's just, I think that the sheer barbarism that they unleashed shows how nervous they are. But no, I do think that the liberal co-optation thing is very serious. You know, it draws out people who weren't serious from the first place, but also does give us a constant push and pull when we should be focusing on more important strategic objectives. Also, one thing that's a bit unfortunate, too, you see from the more radicals in this country, too, as the conflict gets heightened, they kind of pull back, too, because people in the U.S., particularly white revolutionaries, aren't used to the level of conflict that existed. In black society, we're constantly engulfed in a kind of element of violence. It just kind of has to do with, clearly with colonialism, with slavery, with policing. There's always, like, a level of, like, tension and violence that we kind of grow up in American society. And now that that's, like, kind of exploding more, white people have to deal with it in a way, and they kind of push back because they don't necessarily always want to take part in that kind of struggle. But as it gets more heightened, you kind of, to put it blankly, you kind of see who the real ones are.
And in a positive sense about this issue, the rebellion, the George Floyd rebellion, did bring out a lot of people who you wouldn't expect in support of militant action. So there was, like, a huge wave of liberal counterinsurgency, and very, I don't know how I can say, but in a very cheap way, right in the middle of the protest, to try to bring it back into the Democratic Party fold. But it was really pasted on. It was really cheap, and you could see that there was, like, this really this huge shift in society where people who really supported the militant action and supported the fighters in the street, who you wouldn't expect really coming out of the woodwork, are just not going to be convinced by this kind of cheap Democratic Party ploys.
You guys started touching on this in that question, but I'm curious if you could talk more about race dynamics in the streets during this uprising. You know, one of the things you're saying about black people in America having faced a lot of violence in their daily lives and continuing to face a lot of violence, and that, you know, preparing people in a way for what happened in the streets in a way that it seemed like some white people were not prepared. I'm curious if you could talk more about that. I know lots of alternative media about the uprising has talked about how multiracial the protests were, and I'm curious if you guys also found that to be true in New York City, and if you could talk a little bit about what those race dynamics mean in the context of goals that an organization like RAM has that are about, you know, taking down the whole system and not just reforming certain parts of it.
Okay, well, about the multiracial character of the uprising, I think, obviously, the country is so vast that, like, it's hard to generalize too much, because, like, in some places it clearly was, like, mainly, like, black people. Like, in Philly, was, like, a month or so ago, that was almost, like, a totally black uprising. In other places, it was definitely, like, in New York City, for instance, it was definitely multiracial, multigenerational kind of uprising. So, yeah, I think that from what I've heard from comrades in several places, that seemed to be the tenor in most places. But once again, it's hard to generalize exclusively. But one thing we kind of see is that, like in New York, for instance, it was extremely diverse and people were fighting together. And in the streets, there was almost a consensus that we're all in this together. We're all against the police and we're all fighting against this, like, monster together. So it was kind of different than what you see at typical, like, leftist events and demonstrations in the U.S., where there's a really strong push to put everybody in a fixed category and make sure everyone stays in those categories and then to move forward from that kind of understanding. So this was a lot more fluid, a lot more passionate, and a lot more, it clearly had a lot more capacity than a lot of the things that the left had previously put together. How should I put this? So, like, we see that one really predominant thing in the discourse with a lot of leftist movements in the U.S. is the notion of intersectionality and identity politics. And in a lot of those, in the streets in New York, we could see the abject failure that a lot of those politics have put forth from, like, the in comparison to the street movement, and where people from working class backgrounds actually rise up, that the kind of form of politics is actually kind of more alienating, more tied to academic discourse, and really didn't prevail when it really mattered. Most of the people who are practitioners of that kind of either didn't participate or were so sidelined, you couldn't even really tell. So, but I should add that this uprising in general in the New York and elsewhere was a black uprising that was dealing with black liberation and black issues against policing and against white supremacy. So that's like, that is a core of it. People came out in solidarity with that, because people who have like any like element of decency will be appalled by what they were seeing. Nobody could watch that George Floyd video or hear what happened to Breonna Taylor or Ahmaud Arbery or Tamir Rice or any of these things. Should see that and be able to sit home and just be like, oh, this is just another day. So the fact that people came out is really important. It's really powerful. And one thing also I should add is that when white people, when they strike back, when they finally join in the struggle, which doesn't happen often, especially in U.S. history, for instance, like in the 60s, the group like the Weather Underground, people who came and took part, were really a very, very small minority. So, like, throughout U.S. history, it's usually black people fighting for themselves, by themselves. So as people join in more, that's actually how we believe that you'll end up breaking down racial division, racism, and white supremacy. It's as people get more engrossed in struggle together, you start learning how to actually create a world where these differences are, like, shouldn't be meaningful. And obviously that's not just going to happen from a rebellion, but it's like as the struggle continues and as we all fight together against this Leviathan, then we'll start like seeing the humanity in each other.
I would say that RAM as an organization is not shy about showing support for militancy and militant tactics. In the book you wrote a few years ago that kind of launched your organization, Burn Down the American Plantation, it's literally in the title, but you also call for self-defense against a system that is intent on killing black people. And yeah. I think looting and riots were a big part of the uprising in the beginning, and I at least was seeing a lot more people expressing support, at least verbally, for riots than I had ever seen before, in terms of paying attention to certain kinds of tactics in the U.S. in the context of black liberation. And I'm curious if you guys can talk about, do those tactics fit with your analysis of self-defense? And if so, how come? And if not, why not?
I would say that we don't see rioting and looting as self-defense. We view them as, like, totally justifiable, legitimate, applaudable, beautiful actions that should continue daily against the state and against capitalists. But we would probably view it as something a tad different than self-defense. Rioting, for instance, we would probably look at as an expression of, like, a popular outrage, as people rising up against such an unjust system and a disgusting, you know, system that has to be overthrown. Yeah, we think that it's a form of popular outrage, maybe not necessarily self-defense. Looting also, it's a form of working-class people taking back their labor that was stolen from them. So it's like, well, it's totally justified and should continue. Maybe we would probably put it in a little different category. But also, we should be clear that this is kind of like, as far as we view, it's kind of like a semantic in a sense that, like, regardless what it is, it's great and should continue to happen. And it's like a way of pushing back and showing like a militant resistance against white supremacist society. But we would view things that like self-defense in more organized, cohesive and either clandestine or publicly militant ways to protect, say, like, churches, black churches, mosques, synagogues, places that are deliberately targeted by fascist police and white supremacists. Those we would probably put together as, like, self-defense actions. Also, you could probably put more offensive militant actions in that kind of lexicon, too, because offense and defense kind of mold together as you're building capacity against the state.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is an interview with two members of the Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement, a revolutionary anarchist organization based in the so-called United States. We've been talking to them about the COVID-19 pandemic, the George Floyd uprising, and other things.
You know, it's an expression and a language, I think, that's absolutely essential. Because when you really think about it, like, what the police have been doing to people, or what's routinely happening to people in prisons here every day, attacking the windows of some businesses is really, really quite minimal, really quite small. You know, everything that happened in the whole context of the George Floyd rebellion is, you know, kind of nothing compared to this man losing his life in that way. So it's, you know, it's important. I mean, it's small in terms of, like, what has been lost, let's put it that way, but it's important in the sense that people can feel themselves, they have an expression, an outlet for what they need to get off their chests about how they feel about that. But I also think that, like, as we develop the movement and have more organized outlets for people to fight back, I think that will help, because people do need to put this energy towards something where they can feel that they're making headway against the enemy.
Yeah, and I could add one more thing too, that if revolutionaries in the country were better organized, that kind of mass uprising theoretically could have been pushed into something that would have been closer towards revolution. In a way, I think that, like, some of the looting actions, that they were kind of more because there was a lack of direction about where to go next from people on the street than they were strategic. And now, once again, that they should have, that it's a totally justifiable thing and should have happened and should continuously happen, because, like, that is a totally reasonable and valid direction for people to take in the street. But if there was a more organized revolutionary force in the street out here, you could imagine that things probably could have even been pushed even further. So that's something that I think people should take away from this as well.
I feel like that leads into this next question pretty well, which is that obviously RAM has also been very clear on long-term strategies and the need for long-term strategies for bringing about revolutionary possibilities. And you guys have basically already said that you see a lot of possibility in this moment. And I'm curious if you could talk more about how you guys think we get beyond a cycle of demonstrating, rioting, looting in the streets with dwindling numbers until the cops kill someone else and then it all happens again. And if you could talk about whether or not your opinions on these questions of long-term strategy have changed since you wrote Burn Down the American Plantation years ago.
Yeah, that was one of the central points of the text, was that, like, the left is married to this kind of cycle of protests, whereas, like, outrage, you protest, there's this, you protest, and then it's like a cycle and people leave and never come back. And we feel like that is, like, something that's really, it's not, I wouldn't say disastrous, but it's not like it's the cycle kind of needs to be broken by something more cohesive. Yeah, we've changed our views a little bit in just that the situation is so drastic now that we think that people definitely need to be moving with the urgency it deserves. But once again, it's a very complex situation with the pandemic. So it's like we do need to have way more like meetings, way more structure, way more like time to build to try to move quicker. But it's hard since people like being together actually, you know, is fairly deadly in this period. So it's like really complicated in this particular time. One thing we really like people to keep in mind is that there's a step from demonstrations, from organizing demonstrations, from demonstrations turning into riots, from riots turning to insurrections, then insurrections turning to revolution. And we need to be able to recognize when these are happening and how to move when they do happen. And for that to happen, we do need to be able to have some kind of capacity on these downtimes when nothing seems to be going on is when we kind of need to be the most active.
Let's talk a little bit more about analyzing this context, which I appreciate you mentioning as like a skill that revolutionaries can build on. And so I want to talk about this concept of civil war, which feels like it's been very much in the air, both in the mainstream media and in alternative media in the last 5 or 6 months. You know, you guys wrote about it in Burn Down the American Plantation, which came out a few years ago. There was a very popular podcast that came out last summer called It Could Happen Here. But definitely in the last 5 or 6 months, it feels like the talk of the possibility of civil war has become fairly mainstream in America. Does it feel that way to you guys? Does it feel like more people are picking up on what you were saying years ago, or does it feel like people are saying something entirely different? And if it is happening, why do you think that's happening right now?
Okay, well, I think what's funny, when we first mentioned that in the text, I think people thought we were being hyperbolic and being kind of like over the top. But I think we're really just paying attention to what was happening and looking at it in the broadest historical context. So it's, I think due to that, a lot of people have mentioned that, like, they felt that we were right when we first wrote that it was correct. So yeah, as everyone knows, that it's like really a normal kind of point of discussion. People who aren't really politicized see that that's what's going on. The fascists and the Republicans talk about that fairly openly now. So it's like, it's just kind of where the country is now, that it's spiraling towards a civil war. We should also be clear, when we mentioned that in the text, we weren't writing it as if we were yearning for something like that. That's obviously not like a, you know, it's not like a positive development, but it's also, you have to look at the realization of the scenario. And when you realize that, like, people are enslaved in this country and have remained so for decades, hundreds, over 100 years, that it's like been a normal, that's the normal stasis of American society, is slavery for Black people. And that's expanded with concentration camps now for Latino people around the borders, and Muslim people aren't allowed to enter. That this is the status quo, that like white supremacist society, a slaveholding society, isn't just going to be like, just going to drop these things. They're not just going to drop that without a fight. So it's going to take us, really, the more we organize and fight back, the more the repressive nature of this society is going to show its teeth. Yeah, we just feel that that's like, it's almost just like a given. And when the state declares war on you, you don't just give up. If you just give up, you end up walking back into a worse form of slavery than what existed before. That's kind of like the reality of the situation, I think.
Mm-hmm. And it just so happens with the current political context, these divisions in society were kind of driven forward more quickly than we had imagined. So you kind of see this like very strong polarization, like within like American society, with people who are fighting for liberation on the one hand, or sympathetic with a fight for liberation, versus people who are on the right or even the far right, and which is quickly becoming the same thing, who want to see people enslaved, who agree with kind of like this violent stasis for keeping people down and keeping themselves up. So you can see this polarization increasing very quickly, and as it did when, you know, Trump came into power a few years ago, and only was driven further by the kind of people going more towards a liberatory kind of form of self-governance, and then on the other side, people rejecting that and being driven further towards the right. So with this kind of like increased polarization within society, that potential comes up more quickly than, say, if we had 10, 20, 30 years to really like build our capacity to do political education, to kind of work towards this moment. That would look a lot different, but I think everyone's kind of being thrust into this moment where there is this very strong polarization, and there are people on either side who are willing to fight. So the reality of that, kind of like a more hot war, is coming up more quickly than I think a lot of people have predicted.
And I can add one thing too, that there is in the left in the U.S. there's been a debate about, not even a debate, but there's been a question about like that anarchists and revolutionaries should avoid, I think the term is symmetrical warfare. And that's something we also feel that like there isn't, that isn't really a question that I think that we really need to engage in that like there is no possibility of symmetrical warfare when it's a state versus an enslaved populace. So that's not, it's not like the framing we should be looking at. We should really think about the fact that the conflict that drove the country into civil war is never resolved, and the fact that Black people are still in chains. How do you resolve that is a question, not the this question if that, like, what should we do, how far can we take it, is kind of like secondary. Malcolm X, for instance, said that if you show me somebody who tells you what they won't do for freedom, it that says what you need to know about that person. That the question is, what are we going to do to free people and free ourselves? And that's the most important point.
So, in addition to people talking a lot about civil war, I've also been seeing a lot of talk about abolition, which is exciting and is something we talk about on this show and clearly is close to your hearts, given that it's, you know, in the name of the organization that you're a part of. And it feels like a lot of people are talking about abolition. You mentioned how one of the ways that the counterinsurgency seems to be happening is this turn from abolition to defund in terms of talking about the police. And I'm curious if you could talk about, you know, what have been some good and some not so good things about abolition becoming a much more widespread concept to people? Has the concept changed as it has become more well known?
Yeah, well, yeah, definitely. I think that the counterinsurgent nature of the liberals in the U.S., it's really stark. So it's like, yeah, it's very positive that people are learning and reading more about abolition. But, okay, for one, there's a notion that, like, abolition, if you look at it divorced from revolutionary struggle, you can see how it can be taken apart and watered down. So, like, if people focus specifically only on prison and nothing else, or only on ICE and nothing else, you can see how you can start getting into this single issue form of politics that can, like, devolve and take away from a larger revolutionary struggle. That also shows how you got to the whole defund the police thing. Since we're talking about abolishing the police and saying that the only way you can abolish police and prisons is through abolishing the state and capital, which is a really coherent argument, if you take that out of context and be like, oh, we just need to defund them, you can start slowly chipping away at what other people have built and putting it back into nonprofit establishment discourse. So, like, we kind of watch that happen, and it's not odd. It, like, kind of happens every time there is a major uprising or push that you see the liberals and nonprofits all come in and be like, oh, well, we have the mature way of handling this. And then their mature way of handling it always has to do with throwing more people in prison or in these camps. So it's like, we just have to be sophisticated enough to realize that that's what that is, and to not let people like that within our circles and our movement and push back on them when they come out. And there's one interesting thing about the uprisings that happened here. For instance, we have, like, a lot of people who peace police at demonstrations in New York. So it's like whenever things start getting rowdy, people come out and they're like, oh, you can't do that, you can't commit violence. In this one, when people tried that in the uprising, the entire crowd just, like, literally beat the flames out of anybody who was trying to do that. And the tone got set really quickly. And that is kind of like a lesson we need to learn about our political organizing, in that, like, when people try to destroy what we're doing, we need to really hold a firm line with our principles and not let it get watered down. Yeah, if people really want to, for people who want to learn, like, how to keep abolition on course, we would say look at groups like Jailhouse Lawyers Speak and other people who are organizing in prisons, because they are really consistent about what needs to be done. In tandem with people who are, like, really in it for the long term, there's groups like New York City Anarchist Black Cross. And there's a lot of organizations that have been doing things for a long time who have a really consistent line about political prisoner support, about abolition, and about revolutionary struggle against the state capital. And if you can follow these kind of discourses, we think we'll end up really taking the abolition movement in the direction it needs to go in.
You know, I guess, like, this liberal bent in abolition, it did exist before the uprising, so, like, just like within anarchism, is there, just as there's, like, a revolutionary side and a more kind of, like, reformist side, there you could find that within the abolitionist movement in the U.S., like, a revolutionary side and a more kind of, like, reformist side. But, like, I think what you do see is, just like my comrade saying, is, like, the further that the uprisings go in terms of militancy, in terms of the political lines, the further it pushes things in that direction. Because you could see, like, the will of the people taking it in that direction, and it becomes harder to walk things back.
So 2020 has been quite a year, and I'm curious if RAM has any New Year's resolutions for 2021.
Yeah, well, we're going to try to keep connecting with people who are recently radicalized. In New York, for instance, there was so many young people who came out who have never come to anything before, who are really super militant, who really got it. And we've been, like, reaching out to people. We've been doing some prisoner support, jail support for people. So we want to keep building up those connections for the future. We want to keep building up infrastructure projects to prepare for the collapse. whether it's like medical stuff, continuing our coordination with people inside the jails, the prisons, creating more like propaganda infrastructure, like you know, we're working on newsletters and other kinds of way to get information out. And a strategic goal, we want to make sure that people realize the anti-police struggle and anti-prison struggle are two things that have to be taken together. That the struggle for abolition isn't one or the other, but it has to be all synonymous. So while people were really targeting the precincts in this one, we think that the prisons should be the next focal point of the struggle as well. And we also have some new exciting projects coming soon, but we're going to drop those soon. We don't want to jump the gun.
But one thing we can say is that we want more avenues for people who want to get involved in the kind of work that we're doing. So that's something that's really important, is that we can build that out. We can build this political movement and be ready for the next rebellions or whatever's to come.
In terms of how people can reach out to you if they're hearing this interview and haven't heard of you guys before and want more information, whether they're in prison and don't have access to the internet, or people on the outside who do have access to the internet, how can people find you? How can people get in touch?
Please feel free to email us. Our email is the name of our group, Revolutionary Abolitionist Movement @protonmail.com.
We also organize, I have a space called The Base in Brooklyn too. It's called, you could email that at thebasebk @protonmail.com or hit up the Twitter there too.
But if people don't have access to email, you can send us a letter. The address that you send it to is 113 Stockholm Street, number 1A. That's in Brooklyn, New York, 11221.
And yeah, for anyone listening, if you can't get the postage to send it to America, you can send it to the Prison Radio Show and we will forward it to Ram for you. And I will list our address at the end of this interview. Do you guys have anything else you want to add? Is there anything that I missed that you wanted to talk about?
No, that's great. Just always listen to Prison Radio. They know what's up.
The Prison Radio Show is a twice monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have two phone lines. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviera de Prairie Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside.
This is an important message from the lawyers at Trudell Johnson and L'Espérance. There have been several disturbing reports about the conditions in Bordeaux and other provincial prisons in Quebec since the start of the COVID-19 crisis. We are looking into this situation in order to decide whether it is possible to take action. If you are detained in a provincial prison in Quebec, please call us at 438-384-7259 or toll-free at 1-855-552-2723. If we don't pick up, leave your name and a detailed message. We're concerned about things like whether you can access your lawyer, issues with hygiene, safety, isolation measures, and any other problems you have personally witnessed regarding your institution's response to COVID-19. Again, our number is 438-384-7259. You can also call us toll-free at 1-855-552-2723.
You can check out past episodes of the Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. Our next show will air on Thursday, January 14th at 5 p.m. If you're in prison, we encourage you to participate in the show in any way possible. We shared our phone numbers earlier, but if you want to write to us, here's our address. We're The Prison Radio Show, or simply write PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. Thank you so much for tuning into our show. We hope that wherever you are, whatever holidays you celebrate, that you're doing all right given the circumstances, and a special shout out to all our listeners in prison. We're thinking of you, especially around this time of year, sending solidarity in hopes that you all get out in the new year. This is Virginia. I've been your host for today. Stay tuned. Butcher T should be next.
Afternoon, you're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing your wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked to CKT 90.3 FM.